It's a short period of time, but a world of difference between Reformation Day and Election Day. Next on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm your host here on Principles and Policies. I'm going to relate some things today. This is our show, by the way, for November 2nd, 2024. I'm recording it on November 1st, 2024. And I've made references to a couple things. Election Day, Reformation Day. First thing I'm going to do is talk to you about where I was last week. Why you got a rerun last week. Where I was last week was in Mobile, Alabama. And there are a number of reasons that I was in Mobile, Alabama. It's a long, long drive down there. My brother lives in Barry, Alabama, and good luck finding Barry, Alabama. You'll have to get out. You'll have to do a map search on Google Maps or someplace, and you will find this tiny, tiny little town in west central, northwest central Alabama called Barry. That's where my brother lives, and it's about 4 hours north of Mobile, Alabama. So what we did was, my wife and I were going down to see my daughter. My daughter and son-in-law live in Mobile, Alabama, and he is a Coastie. If you don't know what a Coastie is, he's in the Coast Guard. He is a... avionics. He works on electronics in helicopters, and he's also training to be a flight mechanic, who does a lot of work. And he just passed. In fact, while we were there, he passed one of his exams to start to train for certification to be a flight mechanic beyond avionics, which means he would go out on the flights when they go out. Help navigate and do all kinds of things. He helps them land and take off because of the way the helicopter sits and the way the helicopter comes in. Sometimes the pilots can't see the runway. Now, obviously, a helicopter doesn't necessarily need a runway, but they still have to use, you know, the same kinds of runways to take off and to land. So the flight mechanic helps spot for that particular thing. So my son-in-law is training to do that, and he does crawl around in the boom of the aircraft and around in the front up behind the control panels and all that stuff. He learned all that stuff. Before he went and did that, he did a number of things, but he was a car salesman for a number of years. And in fact, the car I drive currently, I bought from him just before he went in the Coast Guard. So, but he is, he's learning his craft. He's learning his trade in the Coast Guard, and it's, the Coast Guard does a lot of stuff before he was at Mobile in what they call the Mobile ATC Air Training Center. He was on the USS Dependable. USCGC, Coast Guard Cutter. He was on the U.S. Coast Guard Cutter Dependable. And most of his duty was in the Caribbean. And they went to Fleet Week in New York. But almost all his tours on the Dependable were in the Caribbean. And made a number of ports, including Haiti. Including the Dominican Republic, including Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, including Puerto Rico, other locales. So he got to see a lot. He was made into the helmsman. They were training him to be, he did become the helmsman on the USS Dependable for a time. And they were also training him on gunnery. Now, United States Coast Guard cutter doesn't have a lot of gunnery, but they have some guns. They have 50 calibers, 50 caliber machine guns, and they have a 40 millimeter gun. And if you can convert that, it's not just short of an inch, which is a pretty good size shell. We visited and got a tour of the hangar and the aircraft that he worked on. And saw where he trains and those kinds of things. But we also went down, first of all, just to do a visit. And by golly, what we did was, and this was fun. This is fun for me. I am a history buff. And we went down to visit two ships. The USS Alabama, and if you don't know, the USS Alabama is a battleship that is in Mobile Bay. It's there on the north end of the bay, where it's berthed, its permanent berthing spot. It's retired, obviously, but it's a beautiful ship. It's very interesting, that particular class of ship. The Alabama is a South Dakota class ship, and it's the last South Dakota class ship built, the battleship built. It's about 36,000 tons, and that may not mean anything to you. That's actually a rather small battleship. You can think in terms of ships like the Iowa class ships. The USS Iowa is more like 48,000 tons. So, and I think I said 36,000 tons for the Alabama. It's more like 38,000. So it's 10,000 tons. The Alabama's 10,000 tons lighter, but the Iowa class, the USS Iowa is 887 feet. The Alabama is 680 feet. So there's 207 feet difference in the size of those two battleships. You did your best in the time. You have to understand when the keels were laid down. The keels were laid down in for the Alabama, the South Dakota class ships, were laid down right around the time that the Washington Treaty, that limited the size of battleships after World War I. There was a treaty that limited the size of battleships after World War I, which is why Germany kicked out what they called pocket battleships. And what pocket battleships were really heavily armed and heavily armored cruisers. And I'm not going to sit here and go into the difference. Normally, a battle cruiser has lighter armor. The guns are not, there aren't as many guns. It's heavily guns still. It was designed as a lighter craft that would have speed. The way that was put by the people that came up with the idea of the cruiser, and I think it was a Jackie Fisher in the Royal Navy came up with that idea, and basically he said speed will be their armor. So in other words, they will be able to get in. Cruisers would be able to get in, throw a punch with their big guns, and don't kid yourself, these are big. We went down in the turret and looked at, they had some shells. Those are big. They're almost, they're essentially the, as tall as a man and as big around as a man. I mean, not quite, 16-inch guns. Cruisers were lighter armored and they were faster. So the idea was they'd get in, get a punch, and get out. And before the enemy could zero in. Because an armor, a large ship with light armor would simply be shot to pieces. And a lot of them were. That battle cruiser theory kind of didn't work out real well. But battle cruisers very often acquitted themselves very well. Very, very well in battle. But also took a beating. Okay, well, let's go back to the Alabama and the Iowa. So, essentially, the Alabama is 207 feet shorter than an Iowa class. And that kind of made it a little cramped. We were able to climb up in the conning tower. My wife couldn't do that. She didn't want to do it. She was tired and her legs hurt. And I was gonna ready to crawl all over the thing. We actually got up in a turret. There was an entrance to one of the turrets where you could get up in there. And the problem was they're redoing some, you know, they're doing maintenance. I wanted to get in and have a look at the breach where they load and fire the thing. I wanted to get up in there. The breach is where that opens up. So we'll take the shells in and the powder. The powder containers are kind of spectacular, as are the shells. It's cramped in there, and it's cramped in that ship in a lot of places, including the living spaces and the, the mess halls. You know, we went into the mess area, and it's basically spread around, different parts of where the galley is. And it spread around like that because they didn't have room to have this one big giant thing full of tables and things. And remember, these guys worked in what they called watches. And what that means is that a watch was a period. I asked my son-in-law when he was on the Dependable how long their watches were, 8 hours or four. And he said four-hour watch, which means you were on duty for four. You were off duty, I think, for eight. And then you went back on duty for four. So in a 24-hour day, there are six watches. And you've heard the term maybe in an old movie with the Navy and the old four bells and all is well. You may have heard that. Well, four bells was the fourth watch. And the watch was broken up into sections. Let's go back to the... I tend to wander on this as I find it fascinating. USS Alabama was a beautiful ship. I would, if you get to Mobile, and I realize Mobile's kind of out of the way. A lot of people just don't, it's not a tourist destination. It's not someplace that's really on the way to anywhere. It is a major city, but it is kind of out of the way on there, way down, way, way, way down on the coast, on the Gulf Coast. And we did take a trip down to the Barrier Islands, Dauphin Island. We went down to Dauphin Island, drove around, and spent about an hour or two on the beach. It's not a majorly spectacular beach. It's kind of a barrier island beach. It's small. We went shelling and did that kind of thing, walked around in the water. But it's a beautiful place. If you ever get down to Mobile, Alabama, make sure you visit the Alabama. When you do, you will also, if you're wise, you'll buy the ticket. It gets you in both those things. They have a little museum that has some aircraft that kind of spans World War II, pre-World War II, and you walk through that up to modern times. And they have a B-52 you can walk around. You can't go in it yet. I think they're getting ready to make that available. Nonetheless, they have other aircraft. They had a number of Coast Guard choppers, retired Coast Guard choppers. And my son-in-law was asking someone he went to church with, and he said, "Oh, I used to fly that big one." Well, it was big. It was a big helicopter. You'd recognize it if you're a fan of older movies, 60s-style movies. If you'd recognize that chopper, you might not recognize the paint job because the Coast Guard paint is orange and white. Nonetheless, they had a number of those things. But they also had a submarine. They had a World War II submarine, the Drum, the USS Drum. And we did take the tour of the Drum. It doesn't take as long to go through the Drum. It's a long, thin tube. I mean, how else do you describe it? You walk through the various tubes, you see the how cramped. Oh my gosh. I don't know if I could stand the idea. I'm already claustrophobic in certain situations. I didn't feel uncomfortable in there. What would have made me feel uncomfortable is being 100 feet under the water in there and knowing that if something would happen to that submarine, I was done for. And the silent service is it takes a specific kind of person to be able to do. And if you don't know what the silent service is, that's the submarine service. It really does take a specific kind of person to be able to do that. It's interesting, we had children going through, and the dad was in front of us, and he said something about, the kid was said, well, where's all the computers? And the dad said, there isn't one. This was all manually operated. And I said, okay, there actually is one. There is one in the conning tower. And I climbed up into the conning tower, and believe me, this is a job for young men. At 67, I climbed it, and I didn't have any real trouble. The real problem was coming back down. I didn't have any real trouble. But there were people who said, nah, I can't get up there. And they couldn't have. My wife couldn't get up because it's a ladder. It's not a stair step. You climb a ladder, and there's a hatch up there that can be closed in case something happens, like if you're on the surface and somebody's out on the outer deck around the conning tower and a plane comes in. If you can't get the upper hatch closed, they have the hatch into the con that also closes. So you can get trapped in there. Again, scary. But I went up into the conning tower, and sure enough, I said, I'm looking for the TDC, and I found it. The TDC, I think it was a torpedo detonator, a detonation computer or calculator. It's got multiple dials on it, and you put in the angle of the ships, the two different, you know, the target and the firing. You put in their speed, which is part of the reason they have a periscope. They can gauge the speed of the ship being attacked. You put in the how fast the torpedo will be traveling, and you can. That's a pretty much a known, all these known quantities, you put them in, and it will tell you what your firing solution is. In other words, how long you can expect if you're close enough, and how long you can expect before you can expect an explosion. So I got up there and found that I was in heaven, and or not in heaven, but I was having just a wonderful time. And the TDC is a mechanical device. It's a mechanical computer, and the dials all worked. So you could actually put in calculations, you could put in the numbers and calculate what was going to happen. Now, what was interesting about this, I'd read some World War II novels on the submarine service, and the fact is that there were XOs, executive officers. The captain would order an attack. The executive officer very often was the guy who had to calculate the firing solutions for the torpedo, and sometimes those guys got so good at operating the TDC, they didn't need the TDC anymore. They could do it in their head. They used the old human computer and calculated all the angles and the speeds and all that stuff, and came up with firing solutions, and which the fore or aft tubes. And by the way, those fore or aft tubes are really cool. What I didn't like in the forward torpedo room is, and I knew this about World War II subs anyway, that there are men who are berthed up front in the torpedo room who are sleeping with torpedoes on top of them and underneath them. Again, one of the reasons why I wouldn't necessarily want to be on a submarine. I'd be the guy who get berthed under these torpedoes, and I don't think I'd care for that. But nonetheless, it was a wonderful trip. The only parallel I have is I've been in Long Beach Harbor, gone to the Queen Mary, but I also bought the ticket for the Scorpion. The Scorpion is a Russian submarine, and the similarities and the differences were kind of striking. Interesting that the captain's, you know, you think of the captain's quarters, right, on a ship. On the USS Drum, it's essentially, he has a little tiny desk in his office, or in his quarters, and the ready rooms are tiny, the galleys are tiny, out of necessity, because submarines are not huge. But on the Scorpion, the Russian submarine, what was interesting was that there was the captain's quarters, and right across the hallway, the gangway, I wouldn't say a hallway, it's not a hallway, right across the gangway was the commissar's office. What is the commissar? He's the political officer on board the ship. You're right. They have political officers on board the ships to make sure that nobody goes south, to make sure everybody's right-minded about how to think about what's going on the submarine, and keep them in line politically with the party. Well, that being said, we did that, but we also, that night, one of the reasons we went down is that my son and daughter-in-law are going to a church in Mobile called Christ Presbyterian Church. It is a PCA church, Presbyterian Church in America, and they were having a Reformation Day conference. And the conference guest was a guy who I've followed for years, and one of the reasons I went down. Now, I told the pastor, I said, this conference is 25% of the reason we came down. The other 75 was my daughter and her husband. But we came down, and always wanted to see James White, Dr. James White out of Phoenix, Arizona, who is a known debater and a known apologist, well known among some of you. Some of you will like him, some of you won't like him, and that's all fine and well. But we went down to see James White do his thing at the Reformation Conference. Now, what is his thing? He, as a debater and an apologist, he did both at this conference. The debate that we went to see was on Saturday night, this last Saturday. It would have been the 25th. Yeah, the 25th. And he debated a Roman Catholic. The Roman Catholic was Tom Riello. And Dr. Riello is with the Archdiocese of Mobile. I think Mr. Riello was chosen by the Archdiocese because he is a former Presbyterian pastor. Now, what does that mean? He gave his background, which is interesting. He grew up Roman Catholic. He says he became Reformed. And honestly, every time I hear somebody who says they became Reformed, and I'm speaking from a Reformed perspective, from someone who didn't used to be Reformed and became Reformed. Everyone who says they became Reformed and then left didn't really understand the Reformed faith, in my experience. And that's my experience here. Tom Riello actually went to, which seminary? I think he said Greenville or one of the Reformed cemeteries that my own church has pastors from that seminary in it. But Tom Riello became a PCA pastor. He got ordained. He took a pulpit. And then he felt drawn back to the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church. And so ended up in Mobile, Alabama. And I don't know how the invitation was put out. And I really don't know all the details of what it was all about. In any case, I keep calling him Dr. Tom Riello. He's not a doctor. So my apologies for that. And I also think I said cemetery instead of seminary. It's been a long, The drive down and the drive back were, shall we say, long. It's 13 and a half hours down there, even though we broke it up. It's exhausting. And it's a long, 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 long drive. The only fun we had was on the trip down was stopping at Buc-ee's. If you don't know what Buc-ee's is, I feel sorry for you. Buc-ee's is a fun place to stop, to get gas, and to get everything else. Everything else. It's a huge place. In any case, let's go back to this. The information on the debate, Mr. Riello and Dr. James White, the resolution, if you know how a debate works, you have a resolution. There's a question, and it's resolved. You say resolved, and here is the resolution. Be it resolved, the true worship of God is nothing less than the self-offering of Christ, which is only offered in the Catholic liturgy. Obviously, Mr. Riello took the affirmative, what they call the affirmative. This is his position, and Dr. White took the no position, the denied. And this was the debate. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play a clip of Dr. White going over his thoughts. We don't care about his feelings. We care about his thoughts on the debate itself. What came out of it? And the reason I'm going to play this is it pretty much matches from what I agree with. This is from the Dividing Line, Dr. White's podcast, The Dividing Line, from right after the debate. This would have been, I think, Monday, I think. And the debate happened on Saturday night. And I'm just going to play Dr. White's analysis of it.
We had pretty good turnout. And on Saturday night, I debated Tom Riello. Now, Tom Riello is a former... Tom Riello is a graduate of RTS Charlotte. And I haven't written to Dr.
Okay, RTS Charlotte, Reformed Seminary in Charlotte, North Carolina. So there's what I couldn't think of.
Dr. Kruger yet, but he mentioned Dr. Kruger and studying under Dr. Kruger at RTS Charlotte. He was an ordained PCA minister up in New York Presbytery, I believe. And he was raised Roman Catholic and then went back to Roman Catholicism just a few years after he graduated from RTS Charlotte, and he works for the Archdiocese and teaches at a school for the Archdiocese there in Alabama. And so I didn't really know what to expect from him. We were debating on the Mass as the only means by which God is worshipped is in the Catholic Mass, in the self-giving of Christ in the Catholic liturgy. How do I describe that debate? I haven't seen any of it. It was only recorded on a phone, so we may only just post the, I don't know. I haven't heard yet about what the video looked like. It was being, I'm sure it was being recorded in the back audio. Hope so. Anyway. And because there was some usefulness to it, even though I did have two Roman Catholic guys come up to me afterwards and say, we've listened to all your Roman Catholic debates, and we're sorry you had to go through that.
This is my experience as well. The pastor, who was the moderator, and what does the moderator do? Basically, he, in normal circumstances, and when questions come up about whether something's wrong, somebody objects to something that's gone on and it's off topic or whatever, the moderator says, yay or nay. Okay. What happened in that debate? And again, you hear Roman Catholics who listen to his debates. Why do they listen to his debates? So they can strengthen their own apologia, their own apologies, their own arguments in favor of the Roman Catholic faith, because they know that Dr. White is a go-to guy on Roman Catholic doctrine and the refutation from the Reformed, well, from the Protestant perspective, and remember, I may talk about this later, but the fact is that Dr. White is the go-to guy. He has debated numerous Roman Catholics, and he lost track of how many really true debates with a moderator and the format he has done. He thought it was somewhere between 193 and 195. And many, many, many of those were with Roman Catholics. Some of them are with Muslims, and some of them are with Mormons. Some of them are with, frankly, apostate Protestants and on the Reformed faith and that kind of thing. So, and some of them, he has debated one of the presentations he gave, and I'll talk about this later, was he gave a segment of a debate between himself and Dr. Bart Ehrman. If you don't know who Dr. Bart Ehrman is, I think he's University of North Carolina, the religious studies. And he's essentially an apostate Christian. Nonetheless, we'll go on.
Okay. I appreciate it. They saw it. They understood. I guess the way I describe it is when we got into... It was sort of, I had to bring out a lot of the key issues in my own presentation, because his presentation was sort of like what I would expect someone to give, you know, in a talk at the diocese for the retirement group or something. It was meant for Roman Catholics. It really was not meant to communicate to anything to anybody else. And so I got up there and I had to try to bring out the real issues as to where the real controversy was at the time of the Reformation. And in fact, it's the same stuff that Trent talked about, the Council of Trent talked about in the 13th session when they were talking about the sacrifice of the Mass. So when the negative side has to bring out what should have been the positive side's presentation, you know, that lessens its real impact. Real value down the road too. But then we got into cross-examination, and that's where the wheels sort of fell off. If both sides do not cooperate in making the cross-examination profitable and worthwhile, there's really nothing you can do about it. How I would liken it. Tom, so tell me, given your view of what happens in the Mass as a propitiatory sacrifice, does it follow that you will have to go to purgatory and be perfected by experiencing satis passio because the Mass in and of itself is insufficient to perfect you outside of your own sufferings? Well, James, I was raised in a middle-class family. That's really what a lot...
That's not really what was said. He's making fun of the rhetoric of the presidential campaigns. Kamala Harris doesn't answer questions. She gives a narrative, and she won't answer direct questions, and she goes into this I was born in a middle class family thing. So that's what he's saying, is that Tom Riello would not answer questions directly, and he wouldn't. This is part of the problem in the cross examination. This is where Dr. White really shines in the cross ex, and we'll go on.
A lot of it was. And he got very animated. He's a New York Italian Catholic guy. And, you know, we've done that a few times. And he was accusing me of changing the subject three times during my... Well, when he was asking me questions, he would do the talk, make point presentation. Finally get around. You've set up a completely false question.
Dr. White had to basically ask, are you going to ask me a question? The way the cross-examination is supposed to work, you're supposed to ask a question, and, you know, based on your presentation, and ask the person to rebut your point. Tom Riello did not do that. And the guy up front at the beginning in his early presentation said, I'm not a trained debater, and I will probably not do well stylistically in this format. And that's a fine admission to make, and we kind of expected it not to be a great presentation. And as he was making his opening point, because he's the affirmative, he gets to make the opening point, the Roman Catholics in the audience, and yes, it was a mixed audience, it was a sold-out debate. The Roman Catholics in the audience became very animated. They were like, woohoo, you know, he's winning. Well, this, you know, it's the opening presentation. He's making a lot of points. But in that cross-ex, during the rebuttal periods, the way it worked was you had an affirmative opening statement where you're supposed to make your points, or a negative opening statements where you're supposed to make your points. And then an affirmative rebuttal, which, in other words, you could get a 5 minutes to rebut the points made in the negative opening statement, and vice versa. And then the second affirmative rebuttal of 5 minutes for each side. And then the cross-examination, where they get to question each other for 20 minutes. Dr. White's beginning to talk about that cross-examination. It was kind of an embarrassment on the side of Tom Riello. He's describing it now. It was terrible.
And then when I'd start to correct it, then he's like jumping in and interrupting. And it was really obvious that he didn't know how to do this debate thing. This was his first debate. I don't think he specifically said that, but it was his first debate. So maybe, you know, it's quite possible he just doesn't even know what the rules are. He doesn't know that you're only supposed to ask questions and how to do that. And because he's just pontificating and filibustering and going on and on. But then when I'm asking him questions, and I am asking him that specific question about satis passio and purgatory, and if the sacrifice of Christ actually perfects those for whom it's made, Hebrews 10, 10 and 14, then why should you have to undergo satis passio in purgatory before you can enter into the presence of God? That is a 1,000% valid question. And he's just losing it. He's telling the moderator that I'm breaking the rules because I'm changing the topic of the debate. There were three times in the cross-ex where I just threw my hands up and said, all right, forget it. Let's just move on. We're not.
And that's true. Dr. White, when Tom Riello refused to basically answer direct questions, refused to address the point that Dr. White had made with his scriptural reference, and this is one thing that we saw over and over and over again in this debate, Tom Riello relied on the Roman Catholic Magisterium and the Church Fathers, and Dr. White relied on Scripture. This is a big difference. This is why Dr. White does so well in these debates, because he makes them about Scripture. And very often Roman Catholics want it to be based on the Magisterium and the Church Fathers and the Roman Catholic tradition. And it's like, when the Roman Catholic tradition and the Church Fathers and the Magisterium contradict Scripture, then which one is supposed to win? The Scripture is supposed to win. And that's the point here, that Dr. White is making.
Not getting anywhere here, because I couldn't get him to interact in any meaningful fashion. Even after that last time, you know, Joshua Sparkman, who was moderating, was like, you know, that's a valid, you know, go ahead and answer that question. And so in the providence of God, what happened was, I opened my Bible, I opened my beautiful Jeffrey Rice Rebind Nestle Allen 28th edition to, guess where? Hebrews 7:25. Why is that important? Well, that was the key with Jason Bretta. That's where he fell apart in the debate in Hebrews 7:20 in Tullahoma. Hebrews 7:25 presents the perfection of the work of Christ as Savior. There's no way around it. There's no way around it in English. There's no way around it in Greek. There's no way around it in Latin. It doesn't matter what language you use. And the Greek is nice and clear and wonderful. And so I got into Hebrews 7:25. And when I first asked him, I said, for whom does Christ intercede? Christ intercedes for everyone. Christ intercedes for everyone. Oh, okay. So, and then I take him into the text. And pretty soon he's saying, Christ, that this intercession does take place in the Mass, but it's only for those who participate in the Mass. It's not for every human being. And so I'm like, well, wait a minute. And so I just keep pressing the text. I just keep pressing the text. And he just keeps contradicting himself. And so we finally get down, and everybody can see what's going on. Everybody can see that the text is saying he is able to save Aistha Ponteles forever and completely because he ever lives to make intercession for them, a specific people. So, can he or can't he? They can always choose to leave. And it was so, you know, I'm like, so you don't believe Hebrews 7:25. And he had been doing stuff where he was talking about, well, limited atonement is your ultimate interpretive grid. And I'm like, no, limited atonement comes from texts like this. This is why I believe in limited atonement. It's because of texts like this. I don't have to bring some interpretive grid and place it on this. You're the one not dealing with what this text is saying. And so I think I did finally, once the Hebrews 7:25 thing became, I could tell for anyone with ears to hear, that had been decided. I'm like, I'm done. I think I still had like 4 minutes left. I think he said it was, at one point it was 4:45.
And that's true. Dr. White just basically said, look, we've answered all the questions with this. With his breaking down Hebrews 7:25, all the questions that had been brought up in the affirmative and in the resolution had been destroyed, and Tom Riello just basically understood that as well and would not answer questions on the subject anymore. I don't want to make it sound like suddenly he had a change of mind. He did not. It became clear to me that he did not understand Reformed theology, even though he'd been to Reformed Theological Seminary in Charlotte. I don't think he really grasped that. And he'd gone back to Rome, which means he abandoned whatever he may have known about that. And it showed in his presentation. Again, I think they picked him because he had been a Presbyterian pastor, but it didn't play out very well in the debate. We'll bring this to an end.
I'm done. There's no reason to press on with this, given how he was non-responding. And he did complain to Joshua later about changing the topic debate. There was no changing the topic of debate. Or anything like it. He just doesn't know how to do a debate. And so, like I said, even a lot of the Roman Catholics were like, sorry about that. And I'm like, you know, it happens. I need to go back. I was going to do this before the program started, but I didn't get around to it. I need to go back. I've lost count. I'm thinking that was 194, but maybe someone can go back, because
Okay, we don't need to go into that. The fact is that Dr. White prevailed by all accounts. I'm sure Roman Catholics. What I know is that on the Sunday after the debate, one of the things that came up was the priesthood of Melchizedek, which Dr. White went into rather extensively. And interestingly enough, one of the Roman Catholics that was there was a friend of my daughter's, who knew her from the Coast Guard. She was a Coast Guard pilot, a brilliant woman, Coast Guard pilot, very, very smart, very active. She's active in her Roman Catholic Church. And she sent Stephanie, my daughter, a screenshot of for the homily on Sunday. And the homily, which for those of you who aren't familiar with Roman Catholicism, the homily is essentially the sermon. The homily was on the priesthood of Melchizedek. Well, she kind of laughed and said, gee, I wonder where that came from, since the priest was there at the debate. I think maybe he thought he might have to refute that in the homily. So does Dr. White have an effect? Yes, he does. And let me tell you, he did some wonderful teaching. He did some wonderful teaching for us. On Sunday, he had the pulpit and at the church. Now, Sunday morning, he did a Bible study. And the Bible study was, it's Sunday school. On Sunday morning, he had the Sunday school, like I said. And the topic is, what is faith? He did a teaching on, essentially, because it's Reformation Day service and a Reformation Day conference. This was all part of a conference. People came in from all around. We may have been the furthest away at about 1,000 miles. But people came in from all around. And he did what is faith? Then in the morning he had the pulpit. He did a sermon on, by grace through faith. Remember Reformation Day. One of the spark plugs? It was Martin Luther's, coming to the realization that faith comes through grace. And he did an exegesis of Ephesians 2, 1 through 10 on that subject. And then in the afternoon at 2, he did a very wonderful presentation on, it was a workshop. Essentially, he did a slide presentation on the reliability of the New Testament scriptures. He went through a lot of Greek manuscripts, it was focused on New Testament. He's also done Old Testament stuff, but he is a Greek teacher. He is excellent at Greek. I first became aware of James White from a book called The King James Only Controversy, where he talked about the reliability of modern versions of the Bible. Some modern versions. This is not a blanket endorsement of all modern versions of the Bible. Some of them are plumb awful, and he says so. But for instance, we talked about the texts involved in the, for instance, I carry a New King James, although I like the ESV. I carry a New King James because I could get the Reformation Study Bible in New King James and nothing else at the time. It was only in New King James. So that's what I carry. But he called up a text and he says, is it in your Bible? And everybody said, no, except I said, yeah, I got it. And he goes, what are you carrying? I said, New King James. He goes, yeah, that's Textus Receptus. And he said, what that is a note. It was a side note that another scribe included into the text. So he explained why some of that stuff happens. And that was a wonderful workshop. We did get to see him debate in a snippet of a debate with Bart Ehrman, and where I watched the debate between Ehrman and White, and it's a doozy. If you want to know where the you can reach stuff from him, it's aomin.org, aomin.org, and he has tons of stuff on his website. Now Sunday night, Dr. White did an exposition and exegesis of Romans 9. Why that's important. Again, Reformation Day service. This is from a Reformation or from a Reformed perspective. And it's wonderful. I'm hoping we can get recordings of that. But in any case, if we do or don't, it was a wonderful experience. If you get an experience to go see James White debate or do teaching, I would suggest you do that. And again, this was for Reformation Day. Some of you Protestants out there, I know you don't really know what Reformation Day is. Reformation Day is the anniversary of when Martin Luther nailed the 95 theses on the door of the Wittenberg Church. Which is the launching point of the Protestant Reformation. And I'm amazed at how some, especially Wesleyan denominations, are completely ignorant of. They may know what Reformation Day is. They know who Martin Luther is. They know what he did. But they don't know what the implications of what Martin Luther did. Frankly, from a Reformed perspective, and remember, Reformed and Lutheran are not the same thing. There are doctrinal differences. We're very similar on some things. Where there is several doctrinal differences between those two. That doesn't mean we don't think that Protestants who don't recognize Reformation Day, or Wesleyan, or are Lutheran, or Pentecostal, or Charismatic, that we don't think they're Christians. We just think we have doctrinal differences, and that's why we have debates, so we can work that stuff out and see what the truth of God's word and Christ's salvation is. That's the whole point behind Reformation Day. Okay, you've heard about my experience in Mobile, Alabama, my experience at Reformation conference at Christ Presbyterian Church in Mobile, Alabama. And again, go see the battleship when you're there. Battleship, Alabama. Now, I need to go on in the very few minutes I have left. I'm just going to go to, remember when we started, we said Reformation Day and Election Day, not much time difference, but a world of difference, because it is a different world. We didn't talk politics at the Reformation Day conference. The way we often think politically should come out of our theology, but sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes we separate those things. Now, personally, a lot of my personal political thought does come from my theology. I'll be right up front. I am a person who does not believe that these are two separate realms. I believe that Jesus Christ is king. He's king of his church, and he's king of his world. And that means that the church should have an influence in the in worldly things. Some Christians want to walk away from that and say, oh, we're not citizens of the world anyway. Folks, yes, we are citizens of heaven, but we're here, and God wants us to exercise our influence in the world around us and win new souls. Does that mean the government can win new souls? No. But it can protect our ability to go out and do the things that we need to do to win souls. And we should be working on winning souls and protecting our right to be out there, being involved in public discourse in the political marketplace. That being said, I really want to talk about, I'm really running out of time, but I want to talk about issue one. Issue one, if you don't know what that is, it's to establish a quote-unquote citizens redistricting commission. This will not do any such thing. It's said to be, you may have seen the ads on TV with Maureen O'Connor, who was the Chief Justice of the Ohio Supreme Court, who was involved in finding the current way that they draw maps to be unconstitutional, which it isn't. It was fine. Really, the way we drew maps, congressional districts every 10 years because of the census redistribution of population and things, it was fine while the Democrats were in charge of the legislature and got to work out the maps. But when Republicans got in office and stayed in office for a couple of census periods, suddenly the Democrats say, hey, it's unfair, it's gerrymandering. And so they come up with this this scheme to, and don't kid yourself, you'll see all kinds of hidey holes, all kinds of different groups that are coming out to endorse issue one. And including Maureen O'Connor, who by the way, ran as the Supreme Court, was Supreme Court Justice as a quote-unquote Republican. Maureen O'Connor's not a Republican, never has been a Republican. She may have that and may be registered Republican, but she is not a Republican. She is not a conservative by any stretch of the imagination. She is a Democrat in Republican clothes. Yeah, I'm not going to take that back. That's what it is. And she's come out and endorsed this quote-unquote citizens redistricting commission. This is not a citizens redistricting commission. This is to build a commission that is not responsible to voters, but who have partisan views. There is no such thing as a neutral view in politics. Everybody out there should know that. There are no neutral views. There are people who have their own set of worldviews and biases. And the Republicans are right up front. They oppose issue one. And it says, if you get a sign, I've got three signs in my yard, says, paid for by the Republican Party. If you get a Democratic yes on one, it doesn't say Democratic Party. It gives you all the names of these groups with great sounding names that essentially shills and stalking horses, front groups. A lot of the money comes from George Soros and associated nonprofits that he's involved in, and people who are taking money from him are involved in. So it's an indirect pass through. But the fact is that what this would do is turn over redistricting to a partisan set of political operatives who will then redistrict to advance their own agendas. And it will be Democrat and moderate dominated. Conservatives will be squeezed out. Doesn't matter who's in the legislature, they'll be squeezed out. This is the commission would have 15 members, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 5 individuals who are independents. Don't kid yourself. These people are political activists. Independents, they're independent political activists, and they will be radicals. So basically, it'll be 5, or it'll be 10 to 5, Democrats plus 5 independent radicals against Republicans. This is a stupid idea, right up front. This is a not only is it a stupid idea, you may not like the way it's done now, and there are ways it could be improved, but the fact is this is not an improvement. This is a complete breakdown of the system and replacement with one that won't work. And I'm urging you to vote no on issue one. If you have not already voted, or you don't understand the issue, because if you don't understand the issue, you should always vote no on anything you don't understand. That's what I do. If it's too complex, and rarely has that happened, but if it's too complex or it seems like there's loopholes in it, I always vote no. So I'm urging you to vote no on issue one if you have not already cast your ballot. Okay, you know what I think. and I do want to know what you think. You can get a hold of me at chairman@principledpolicy.com. That's chairman@principledpolicy.com. And since you do know what I know, and I want to know what you know, I would ask you to join me again next week for another Principles and Policies.